You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Hello and welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Deacon Stephen Gerdanis, also called Reverend Mr. Stephen Gerdanis. What are other appropriate titles?
I'm actually not a Reverend Mister.
I'm technically not,
because it turns out that particular style, Reverend Mister, is for deacons who are transitional deacons, who are deacons on their way to becoming priests, permanent deacons, according to the relevant document which governs such things, apparently, are simply to be referred to as deacon. So there you have it. Yes.
Deacon. So, you know, this is more granular than perhaps most people have ever gotten.
I was already ordained and a deacon before I found that out.
Oh, okay.
A number of us were in our class. That information circulated among us, and some of us were like, "Oh, you know, on the bulletin it says Reverend Mister. I'm going to have to call the church secretary and get that changed."
Well, that's this is why we do this show. I remember somebody had something about like all the various nomenclatures for how you're supposed to refer to various grades of clergy and all this stuff. Yes. And plus, it's like different in different parts of the world.
Oh, sure.
So what you call some bishop or priest or monsignor or whatever or deacon in England is like a different thing than in the United States. And who knows?
You're up monsignor. You use monsignor for a bishop. A bishop.
Really?
Yes, in Europe.
Sure.
Yeah.
I see things I never knew. I'm still baffled by this stuff. So I get all tongue-tied, especially when I'm in the presence of a bishop, because I never am sure what I'm supposed to call them. Am I supposed to call them bishop, or is it your eminence, or is it some other thing? And if they're a European bishop, is it a different thing? I understand father. I could call a priest father. I get that. I call you deacon. But after that, I have no idea what I'm supposed to say.
Have you ever seen the movie Romero, starring Raul Julia as Archbishop Oscar Romero?
I've seen bits of it, but I've never seen the whole thing.
San Salvador, of El Salvador. Well, he was the Archbishop of San Salvador, which is the highest ecclesiastical office in El Salvador. It's a very good movie. Uh-huh. I recommend it. It is one of the few church produced movies which is any good at all. And Romero he's very good in it. I mean Raul Julia is very good as Romero in it, and there are a lot of things that I like about it. Anyway, the reason that I mentioned it, we don't have to talk about it, although I'd be happy to talk about
let's keep going.
Is that if you were an American viewer and you're watching it, it's filmed in English, but it uses some of the customs that are local to El Salvador, and one of them is that Archbishop Romero is referred to as Monsignor. And I was originally thrown by this. I was like, wait a minute, they're talking about possibly making him the Archbishop of El Salvador, and he's not even a bishop yet. But it, you know, well, Monsignor, it just means my lord. And mm-hmm. So it can be used different ways in different places. And here in the United States, it is an honorific for specially honored priests. And it doesn't mean a thing beyond that. It's just you're a priest and your bishop, you know, gave you this special honor. And but in Latin America and elsewhere, it is used for bishops.
Proper title of address for bishops. Meanwhile, in America, and especially in the New York area, there's a high chance that you're going to wind up being called at some point Deke.
This is very true.
And that doesn't even secretly please me. I mean, I'm just openly delighted by that thought.
Yeah.
So very good, very good.
Father is also high on the list of things that deacons are inappropriately called.
Yeah, yeah. You know, we had a about, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago. Was it longer ago than that? We used to have a medieval fair at our parish. Our parish is a Dominican parish. And one of the priests there said, you know, come on, Dominicans practically invented the medieval period. We should have a medieval fair. And so we did this. And so parishioners came and we, you know, dressed in various costumes. So my wife and I, of course, we cooked up the classic bed sheet toga-esque kind of thing, although medievals didn't really wear togas, but it looked vaguely, you know, robe-ish. We went to the medieval fair. We had a wonderful time. And we went into the sanctuary for some reason or other. I forget why. And we're wandering around the sanctuary, and sure enough, somebody who was visiting... Our parish is a like a national registry thing to visit.
I don't know what that means.
Well, the National Registry of Historic Sites has various locations on it throughout the United States that are marked down as this is a local architectural treasure or thing that you really should see while you're in Seattle. And so my parish, Blessed Sacrament, is one of those because it's a neo-Gothic structure. It's really quite a beautiful parish, I must say. And so anyway, we get tourists who just show up to see the parish, or in this case, they were there for the medieval fair. And so I had some random stranger walk up to me, sure as shooting, while I was in the sanctuary, and asked me if I was a priest, because I was wearing a bed sheet. But that delighted me so much. And I've got a Dominican friend, actually, a Dominican priest who was assigned to my parish. And when he was in formation down at in Oakland, California, one day he was at Golden Gate Park sitting in his car reading a book or something. And he noticed this guy kind of gesticulating at him in the car next to him. And the guy had rolled down the window. And so he rolled down his window and said, I'm sorry, can I help you? And the guy looked at it with great interest and said, are you a druid? and he was wearing his Dominican habit. He said, I'm sorry, I'm a Catholic priest. And the guy was like, oh, and rolled his window up. So you have much to look forward to. I will be thrilled to hear your stories.
In my circles, you know, in my film circles, for instance, certainly being a plain ordinary deacon is somewhat exotic. I think you probably remember the story that I told you about having a conversation with the Monsignor, that is the honored priest of our parish, about who was going to do the homily on Sunday at a movie screening, sitting next to one of my atheist film critic friends. He was like, that's not the normal sort of conversation that you would hear at a movie screening. I have film criticism generally, at least in the New York area, it's a very secular business. And right. Whenever I hang out with film people in the New York area, you're almost in that, when you're in that position, you're almost a curiosity.
Oh, yeah.
You're like a strange exotic visitor from another world. And everyone's very interested to know, you know, how it is that you have this interest in film, but you also have these strange religious views and commitments and how those things fit together. And
how is it that you can be Catholic and actually enjoy movies at the same time? How do you achieve that? It's amazing. Did we lose you?
No, I'm still here.
Oh, okay. That's just Well, you know, it's cool though, because you do wind up just because you are as exotic as a Hottentot in that environment, being a Catholic deacon, it also, of course, it becomes an instant way to strike up conversations. People have questions for you.
Absolutely.
We will be back right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Deacon, or as people call him, Deke, Stephen Gradonis. And we'll be back right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
And welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Deacon Stephen Gradonis and talking about life at the Bijou. What's happening out there in movie land?
Well, I have written my first new review of the year for a 2017 film. It's opening in theaters this weekend, and since it's now almost mid-February, I think you'd have to say I got a little bit of a late start. but you couldn't pick a more eventful picture, especially for the kind of film writing that I do and my particular interests, than the Lego Batman movie.
Yay!
The Lego Batman movie.
So happy.
which if you saw the original Lego movie, then you already got your first taste of Lego Batman as voiced by Will Arnett. Yes. doing a kind of a riff on Christian Bale, but I actually think he sounds better than Bale. I'm not sure, but it's possible that Will Arnett might actually be my favorite Batman voice of all time.
Really? Okay.
Yes. Yes. Okay. I know people who prefer Kevin Conroy from the Batman the Animated Series, who consider him the definitive Batman voice. And, you know, even when they read comic books, they hear Kevin Conroy's voice in their heads, but I like Conroy, but I find he's a little bit of a lightweight for me, from my idea of Batman. Okay. And while I don't think Lego Batman is my ideal Batman, I think there's a real possibility that Will Arnett might be the ideal voice of Batman.
Your favorite voice? Okay, I could buy that. He's certainly hilarious.
So I can.
Not what you want all the time in a serious Batman movie, but in Lego Batman, he's just fantastic. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, no. So I can hear the enthusiasm in your voice. And once
big
again,
fan of Lego movie.
Yes. People who have seen the Lego movie will know why, because let us talk for a little while about the greatness of the Lego movie.
Okay. Yes. I'm ready.
Because when it came out back in 2014, it was not a particularly great time for animated films or for family films. And the Lego movie was just a blast of fresh air.
It was so great.
Well, what were the things that made it great, though? See, this is the job of film criticism. You have to connect the dots in a movie and talk about why it was great, because it does some things that a lot of animated films do that are not my favorite thing. And one of my big bugaboos with Hollywood Family Entertainment And one of the reasons that I've so enjoyed films, recent films like Pete's Dragon and Cinderella from Disney, the live action, and even Steven Spielberg's The BFG, is that American family entertainment, especially animation, is addicted to frenetic narrative momentum. Everything has to happen at a million miles an hour. The jokes have to come faster and faster. The action beats have to, there's no downtime. You can't let anybody get bored. You can't let anybody, you know, catch their breath. And I think I think it's generally a problem in American entertainment and in family entertainment, especially. It's one of the things that I enjoy so much about the films of Studio Ghibli. They're leisurely and they let you catch your breath and they.
Oh. Hello.
Oh, can you hear me?
You dropped out there for a second.
Okay, but I'm back.
Now you're back. Okay.
So the Lego Movie does this very frenetic thing that a lot of other animated movies do, and I certainly wouldn't want to see that kind of pace in every movie. But one of the reasons why it works in the Lego Movie is that the Lego Movie is satirizing almost everything else.
it's so true.
And this is, I think, where its real genius is, holding up a mirror to the consumer culture that produces movies like the Lego Movie. Mm-hmm. You know, it gives us Emmett, voiced by Chris Pratt, who is a blank slate, a guy who's just like everyone else, only more so. And his favorite restaurant is any chain restaurant. And his favorite TV show is the most popular, simplest, most broad-based sitcom available on television. Where are my pants? And we all know what his favorite song is, right?
It's the favorite song that everybody else listens to. The only one there is.
Right. Even the robots, when somebody mentions it, they're like, that's my jam. And, you know, that's where you get people sitting in a boardroom saying, let's make a computer animated family film about Legos. Let's brand it and package it. But I don't know whether they made the mistake or they had the brilliant inspiration to give this to people who would turn that premise on its side and make fun of it. That's what they do in the Lego Movie. And they turn a lot of other premises on their sides as well and just fuse it together into something really kind of magical and special. Oh,
I love it. It is such a great movie. It's one of those, there aren't a lot of them, but this is one of those films that I will drop everything and I'll watch it again because it is endlessly funny. Oh, love it. Yeah. So anyway, go ahead.
Well, so the Lego Batman movie now.
Yes.
One of the things that a movie that is not necessarily so great as other movies, one good thing about them is that watching a movie like that is an exercise in clarifying your thinking as you think about what is it about this movie that's not as great as this other great movie.
Oh, no, don't say this. You hold my heart in your hand, Steve. Don't destroy my hopes. Go ahead.
I'm not here to tell you that the Lego
Batman. I'm trudging now to the executioner's gallows.
You know,
go ahead.
The guy who hates superheroes?
This is totally different. This is a Lego superhero. All those things are exempt.
All right. Well, the good news is I'm not here to tell you that the Lego Batman movie is a bad movie because it's not.
Oh, well, okay.
Yes, it
is not as good as the Lego movie was.
But it's fun. And okay. some of it is very funny. I did laugh out loud a number of times while I was watching it.
All right.
And the more that you know about Batman culture through the decades, and I mean, you know, going all the way back into the 1930s when he was created, And the more you know about superhero lore generally, the funnier of a movie it is. And I think that, you know, I probably know that terrain better than you do, but you know it well enough to get a lot of this movie.
Sure.
So it's fun and it's funny, and it does do something valuable. It has one good idea. It's almost, I think, the movie's only really good idea. It had the opportunity for others, but it kind of squandered them. But its one good idea is it takes the character who is the quintessence of superhero cool, the superhero that everybody wants to be, that everybody just looks up to and admires, and it cross-examines him and says, what if he's not as great as we'd all like to think that he is? What if actually Batman's coolness is some kind of limitation or defect in his personality? And it goes some interesting places with that. So I think that that's actually in our culture, where it just seems like more and more superheroes are going that route of being, you know, dark and brooding and violent, and not necessarily somebody that you would want to hang around with. I think putting that on the couch and psychoanalyzing it and saying, yeah, what's actually wrong with this picture? That is something that I appreciate.
Okay. Very good. Well, I'll go see it. And I'm just going to ignore all of your hate speech. your buzzkill, Mr. Fancy East Coast film critic. Us out here in flyover country. Well,
you're not now. Come on, man.
I am down here in the trenches with regular people, just regular, ordinary people who appreciate simple things. And, you know, I'm going to go see it along with my we band of brothers. That's what we're going to do. And it's going to be great. And so there.
It does have some things in it that are pretty great.
All right. I'm looking forward to it.
And there are some good jokes, and there are good jokes for, you know, people like you and me who are older type people who will recognize some of the references that the young whippersnappers won't.
That sounds perfect to me. Right. All right, I think I found my date movie tonight with Chance. Good. You are listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Deacon Stephen Gardanus, and we're talking about what's going on at the movies, and we'll be back right after this on Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Deacon Stephen Gardanus. Thought we'd take a little time and talk about the Oscars. We started talking about the Oscars last time, but, you know, before we go to the Oscars, there's just something that I wanted to mention here. A website called Movie Pilot says that Fox has double dog dared Joss Whedon to make a reboot of Firefly. They said that they're willing to get the ball rolling with Firefly if Whedon wants to do that. I personally find that to be extremely good news. Others are disagreeing with me and think that Firefly was a terrible show. I don't understand that kind of mentality and wonder if they should be allowed to vote. But still, you know, it is a free country and people are allowed to have their stupid opinions. So, but anyway, are you a Firefly fan?
Yes. Yes, I am. I believe, if I remember correctly, there were only 13 episodes made.
Right.
And then, of course, there was the
Serenity.
The movie Serenity.
Yeah.
And the movie has its problems. It's, you know, Joss Whedon is a very Whedon. I think it's pronounced actually Joss Whedon. He's a very clever writer, and he has a lot of good provocative ideas. I think that he can sometimes be too ruthless as a storyteller, which is a problem for a number of different directions. But Firefly did a number of interesting things, and one of them was to examine the kind of Revolutionary War / Civil War type scenario that you have in a movie like in a series like Star Wars, and say, well, what happens if essentially what happens if the Empire wins? What happens if it's like telling the story of the Civil War from the perspective of the Southerners.
Right.
You've lost, and now you're just kind of moving around on the outskirts of society, and of course the main character Mal was conceived from the beginning as a kind of a Han Solo roguish figure who doesn't. He's a good guy, but he doesn't lose his edge and become completely rehabilitated the way that Han Solo does.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting, speaking of which, because what a lot of Americans have forgotten is particularly at the very birth of the cinematic art form. Note that word that I just used there is a clever segue. What you got repeatedly were, in fact, stories that told the story of the Civil War from the perspective of the losers.
Sure.
So most famously, of course, Birth of a Nation. But it was you also get it in other films that are some of the most important films in our entire cinematic legacy. The number one example being Gone with the Wind.
Sure. Another important example being Buster Keaton's The General.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And so there was at the beginning and really, you know, in the years following the Civil War, you do get, you know, the reality that we won, the North won. You get that shows up, of course, in our politics. But there is a lot of romanticizing and regret and, you know, is it really all, 100% good thing that the South lost? Kind of questions being asked over and over again in American public life. And what really, I think, drives a stake through that story is the rise of the civil rights movement.
Mm.
We're still seeing today that it's not quite dead, you know. So you get the Confederate flag waving and this kind of thing, and but I really think that you can see as long up until. I remember a Twilight Zone episode in the early 1960s in which, a Confederate Southerner is offered the chance to win the Civil War with the use of witchcraft. And he gives this big speech where he finally says, you know, well, if it's a lost cause, at least let it be buried in hallowed ground. That's not a line that I think would sell very well today. But it's significant that it takes so long, I think, for Americans to put that to rest and to get over that romanticizing of the Confederate cause. And so it's interesting that Firefly kind of revivifies that, but separates it from the American Civil War.
Yes, it puts it in a completely imaginary context.
Right.
And another interesting thing that it does is it puts a character who is not only religious but a clergyman into mm-hmm. the center of a genre which is not often dealt with religious themes in quite that way.
Yeah.
You know, and the archetype here, I think, is probably Star Trek, which embodied Gene Roddenberry's secular humanist perspective. You know, and religion crept into the story in the later movies and then into the TV shows. But his original vision, his basic vision is based on science and rationality and humanism.
Right.
And religion
right.
It doesn't really have a part. There's no religion on board the Enterprise. There are no chaplains. There are no chapels. You know, there's no anybody who's going to get married is going to get married by the captain and so forth. And Mal's ship is not like that. There's a clergyman among the crew, and that's a very interesting thing, especially considering that that Whedon is an atheist, and particularly you know, he's an atheist of the rather anti-God variety.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but a good enough storyteller to recognize, very much like J. Michael Straczynski, very ready to recognize that. Look, this is a human phenomenon that is not going to go away. So incorporate it into your storytelling. And he wrestles with those questions. I love, you know, he names the character. This is about, I mean, talk about a name that's just fraught with archetypal significance. His name is Shepherd Book.
Shepherd Book.
That he incorporates that character right into that universe, right from the outset. And you know that he's going to be, he's not treated with disrespect. He's not a he's not a, kind of a wimp the way that, for example, Father Mulcahy was in MASH. You know,
it's a fair criticism.
And he's not an idiot the way Frank Burns was in MASH. You know, he really does call people like Mal to accountability. Respect for that.
Yeah, and it would be interesting because, you know, anything that Whedon would do with Firefly going forward, I mean, obviously, I'm presuming it would be with a completely new cast, and mm-hmm. You know, it would probably be a true reboot. It would not exist in the same universe with exactly the same continuity as what we saw. This would be my guess. He would take this opportunity to reimagine it and to put things in a different context, and that kind of thing always interests me. You know, mm-hmm. I some people get attached to a particular canonical version of a story, and any attempt to rethink the characters or the events from a different perspective is troubling to them. And, you know, when I was in college, I studied Arthurian literature. Mm-hmm. And I was fascinated with how the characters would change from one telling of the story to another. And, you know, so for instance, in Middle English literature, often Gawain, not always, but often Sir Gawain is the quintessential knight, the flower of chivalry. He's mm-hmm. he's the perfect knight. And then in some of the French romances, where you have the French hero Lancelot emerge uh-huh. as the flower of knighthood, and then later it becomes Galahad when Lancelot himself falls from purity. Gawain has to be taken down a peg, and so he becomes a stickler for the letter of the rules rather than the spirit of chivalry, or he becomes flawed, or he actually even becomes a buffoon. Mm-hmm. And that kind of reinterpretation of characters, I think that's very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, you know, with Sir Gawain, what you also get is this hard look at the drawbacks of honor culture, as in, for example, making rash vows. It's a bad idea.
Sure.
And that's something that comes up in Scripture as well on a number of occasions. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Deacon Stephen Gradonis, and we will be back on Breadbox Media right after this.
If you enjoy listening to Mark Shea and all of his wonderful co-hosts here on Connecting the Dots, then consider becoming a friend of the show and provide your support today. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show. Thank you.
Welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Deacon Stephen Gradonis. And we've been talking a little bit about the work of Joss Whedon. And as far as I can tell, he hasn't done anything since he made Age of Ultron. I don't pay close attention, so I could be wrong. But it's been argued by others that making Age of Ultron was just a traumatic experience that just cracked poor Joss Whedon, and now he's like hiding or something, or coping or healing, or you know, holed up in his shell or something. And I was mentioning to Steve during the break that I read an interesting saw an interesting review that Bishop Robert Barron did of Age of Ultron, in which he argued that this was Joss Whedon hawking his Nietzschean philosophy that he's written on Nietzsche, and that this was just kind of a straight up Nietzschean tract. And you, Deacon Stephen Gradonis, spiritual leader to the masses, you disagreed with this, and
I think he has a point. There's certainly Nietzschean influence in Age of Ultron. I don't know. I mean, let's recall that the foundational figure in the modern superhero mythos, the definitive superhero, is also called Superman.
Right.
He's not a Nietzschean figure in many ways, but you're not going to have characters in this genre and put Nietzsche entirely in a corner and not have to think about him. Nietzsche is going to be a figure that's involved in the discussion of any superhero movie if you go deep enough, or any superhero mythos.
Right.
That said, there are some themes in some superhero movies that are more evocative of Nietzsche than others. I like Bishop Barron's observation that the statue at the end of Age of Ultron that has all of these figures from the film in this kind of quasi-classical... Locked in eternal struggle. That was a very... And his observation that this was in the style of artwork... preferred and advocated by the Third Reich. I thought that was a very interesting observation. That said, you know, you have these two figures, both in one way or another, from Tony Stark's attempts to put, you know, to throw aside the men was not meant to meddle medley and bring forth salvation for humanity. Mm-hmm. And the bad guy, Ultron, is much more evocative of a Nietzschean Übermensch than the one who actually triumphs in the end, which is the Vision. Mm-hmm. Ultron sneers at the Vision and says, Stark asked for a savior and settled for a slave. Mm-hmm. If that's accurate, if that's an accurate observation of the Vision's role in the story, then he would seem to be aligned more with the Nietzschean slave morality than the master morality of the Übermensch. Mm-hmm. But when you ask Vision himself, "What are you about?" His response is, "I am on the side of life," and he's a protective figure. And throughout the film, the Avengers' primary concern is with protecting the anonymous, small, nameless human beings who are in the crossfire in this story. None of that seems very Nietzschean to me.
Right. And in fact, I mean, that's kind of what kicks the drama off and Tony Stark's crisis is, you know, we dropped a building on this anonymous, you know, little guy who just happened to be there. And his mother confronts him, says, you know, you killed my son with all, you know, while you're busy being heroes.
I think that was actually in the next movie. I think.
Was it? Oh, okay. Oh, you're right. You're right. It's in Civil War.
Right.
But even that, I mean, it underscores that, with this titanic an ego as Tony Stark has, he does. He is somebody who is aspiring in the right direction. And not a Nietzschean direction of, you know, well, too bad, you know, the strong survive and the weak perish.
Right.
But in addition to, you know, confronting perhaps the greatest evangelist of our age on his wrongness and daring to tear down this great man publicly, you also argued with him about silence.
Yes, the Martin Scorsese. Yes. Well, you know, again, not exactly arguing. let me just say, first of all,
by the way, can I go ahead and give out your home phone number for people to call you about these things?
I love Bishop Barron. He is my hero.
I know you. I'm just giving you a hard time.
I said so publicly on Facebook just last week.
Okay, good.
Yes, he does so much that I think everyone needs to look at Bishop Barron and try to do what he's doing on some level in your own world. And that's what I'm trying to do in my own world.
Yeah, and you do it well, by the way. For all of my giving you a hard time.
Well, Bishop Barron looks at a movie like Silence from the perspective, I think, of an evangelist and a pastor, which he is. And the mission of the film critic, my mission, is a little bit different from that. And Bishop Barron's response to Silence is, first of all, he's read the positive commentary from Catholics, and his perspective is, you know, these people are praising the film for its subtlety, for its complexity, for its nuance, for its ambiguity, and he doesn't deny any of that. He says, granting all of that, are ambiguity and nuance, are these really such helpful ways for us to approach the topic of faith in our times? Or is this rather what supports other cultural elites, whether it's the cultural elites in Japan who are trying to squash the Christians or the cultural elites today who are trying to squash us? Would it not serve us better to emphasize things like clarity and boldness and strength? And I can completely agree with that as far as it goes in terms of our engagement with the world today. Even on that level, though, you know, we have to be clear when we say, you know, here where we're going to draw the lines in terms of conscience and here's where we're not, that we don't, you know, there are mistakes that can be made in this regard. And I think we've seen, you know, even in regard to something like, can a Catholic civil clerk sign a marriage certificate or issue a marriage certificate for a same-sex couple? And, you know, is that really a violation of conscience, or is that something that we would rather not do, but that your conscience doesn't absolutely prohibit you from doing? And there's been some very interesting, you know, discussion on that point. And I think we have to be willing to go into those kinds of questions and ask those kinds of questions. And that, to me, is what silence does with the question of apostasy. Because apostasy is one of those things that's always wrong. But you have to confront the fact that in this particular story, the Catholics who are like the priest in the story who's being told, you have to step on this image of Jesus and renounce your faith. He's not doing it to save his neck. There are these other people, these random bystanders, people who have already complied with everything that they were asked to do. And they're the ones who are being tortured to death. Mm-hmm. And we need to at least be honest and ask ourselves the question. And it was very thoughtfully put by a science fiction writer who's also an atheist, Adam Roberts, in an essay on silence. He says, if you were tortured for your beliefs, it would, of course, take strength to hold out. But if others are tortured for your beliefs and you still refuse to yield, do we still call that strength?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very hard question. We do need to recognize that there are things that are intrinsically immoral that we may not do for any reason. And apostasy, repudiation of the Christian faith, is certainly one of those things. Then you have to ask the question, does the act of stepping on an image of Christ always necessarily entail apostasy? You might think the answer is obvious. You might think we shouldn't even be asking that question. That gets us into unhelpful ambiguity. I think of Thomas More in A Man for All Seasons arguing with Meg about the possibility of signing the Act of Succession. She doesn't think he should even look for a loophole. She says, Father, what does it matter what it says? We know what it will mean. And he says, it will mean what the words say. And he goes on to say this great speech, God made the angels to show him splendor, as he made animals for innocence and plants for their simplicity, but man he made to serve him wittily in the tangle of his mind. And if he suffers us to come to such a case that there is no escaping, then you know, we can be heroes, but it's God's part, not ours, to bring ourselves to such a pass. Our natural business lies in escaping. And that's why I think we need to ask these questions about this.
Well, man, bravo. That was great. and look, we're out of time. Deacon Stephen Gardanus, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today and for all of your incredibly intelligent commentary. Our producer today was Danny Head. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we will be back on Monday with Sherry Antonetti. Until then, have a fantastic weekend. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.